Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Everybody and welcome. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, WCTCAM.com, or download our podcast on iTunes.
Hey, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm doing very, very well. How are you?
I'm well indeed. I'm glad to be back in the Restaurant Guys radio chair.
Yeah, we took a little time off. It was well deserved, I think.
Yeah, and we're going to start today's show. Next segment, we're going to bring on Aldo Sohm. Aldo Sohm is the sommelier at Le Bernardin restaurant with Eric Repair, who's been on our show. He's the chef owner, Eric Repair, and he was just nominated or just elected this year the best sommelier in the world. That should be a lot of fun.
So I want to talk to you this morning, Francis, about something I'm fairly certain you don't know that much about.
Okay.
It's lots of things. I realize that could be really? That could be lots of things.
Haven't narrowed the field very much.
But I know you don't watch conventional television, so you probably haven't been following the latest Rocco DiSpirito. Now, for those of you who don't know Rocco DiSpirito, one of the world's most talented chefs who had a show on a reality TV show called The Restaurant.
Yeah. Great chef.
And he is a super talented chef. But do you know what he's been doing with his time lately?
Nope.
He's been on a show called Dancing with the Stars.
No, he has not.
He has been on a show called Dancing with the Stars. And
I'm sorry. You know that I like the guy personally. Mm-hmm. I think he's a great guy. I'd just like to offer him some advice. Cook. Cook. You're beautiful when you cook. Cook in a restaurant and let people have the food that you cook. Train people to cook and be the executive chef. I had some of the greatest meals in our lives were had by that guy. You know the chances of... And look, I'm going to the opening night of the New York City Ballet in less than a month. That's going to be great dancing. You know what I mean?
I need to preface this, and we've talked about Rocco a couple times when he was doing his show, the restaurant, and how we felt it was a mistake for him to be doing going down the career path he was going. You know, who am I to tell somebody that their career path is a mistake?
Well, especially somebody richer than you, like Rocco DiSpirito.
But Rocco cooked me one of the top five meals of my life.
Right, and you spent your whole life looking for great meals.
Exactly, and this is my profession, one of the top five meals of my life. And Rocco DiSpirito is not as good a dancer as Warren Sapp, okay? They're on the same show together, okay? And Warren Sapp did a better job than Rocco DiSpirito. And again, Rocco DiSpirito is a fine dancer, okay? He's a fine dancer.
But if you're one of the best chefs in the world, why are you going to dance?
He's one of the greatest. I mean, that's like Yo-Yo Ma saying, you know what, I really like baseball, so I'm going to, instead of doing this whole cello thing, I think I'm going to do, I'm going to coach a beer softball league.
Mm.
You know, I'm going to play the outfield in a beer softball league. I'm half kidding about this, but I'm half serious about this. You almost have a responsibility, I think, when you are one of the world's great artists at whatever it is that your art form. And Rocco DiSpirito is one of the world's great artists, okay? And I almost feel like when you're in the top 0.0001%, when you're literally one in a million at some field or another, that...
That's exactly 1 in a million, 0.001%. That was good. I like
thank
that.
You. But when you're a talent like that, and a talent that is a creative talent, so other people get to enjoy your talent.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is right.
That there's almost a social responsibility, and you know, if Rocco was spending all of his time doing cooking shows or doing teaching or whatever, I would be okay with that, but I would still be saying, you know what, please go be in a kitchen and cook food and show people to how to cook food and spread this religion, that this extraordinary ability you have. Let people enjoy that. I really do feel that there's a social responsibility there for him to use that God-given talent.
Well, you know, that brings up another point, and you know, I wonder when you next see Rocco if he's gonna pat you on the back or punch you in the nose. I don't know which, but I hope I'm there.
I don't
just to witness it. But you know, that brings up another responsibility, or not a response, another aspect of great food. It's interesting to me. I do think that great chefs and even very talented cooks who maybe don't have refined skills, and you and I have commented on this many times, they have a point of view mm-hmm. that is expressed in their cooking. And you know, you can look at certain dishes and be like, ah, Daniel Boulud, mm-hmm. that's a Boulud. And I think actually you can do that less with Daniel Boulud today. Mm-hmm. But when Daniel Boulud had just Boulud and was on the market with the first Boulud and even then the second Boulud, that was Daniel Boulud's food. Alfred Portale, you know.
Mm-hmm. No doubt about it.
When he was at Gotham, you know, his food now, his point of view changed. A lot of people now copied that for a long time, and it was the dawn of a movement. But you know what's funny is a lot of the folks who copied his food, their food looked very dated, and that they've changed. But he's still operating from that point of view consistently from the 80s through today, and it's still true from him, and it's still done well from him, because he is an artist and it's his point of view. And I know that that sounds very highfalutin, eggheady. Boy, are we off on a rant here. But I think that's what great food is. And I think even you at home, you can sort of develop your own voice. You know, you may hear if you come from a food family, you may hear your grandmother's voice in the food, or see your grandmother's voice in your mother's food. And I think that's one of the reasons that food is so socially important. And especially when people care about it and express themselves through their cooking.
You know, you've hit on exactly what the whole point of this is. I think right now, like, the world would not be as interesting a place if Picasso had never painted. I think right now we're missing Rocco DiSpiritu's point of view in the kitchen.
Well, when we come back, we're going to talk with another person who really has changed from a restaurant that changed the way America cooked fish. Eric Repair is the chef at Le Bernardin. And, you know, being a fish chef, we've talked with Rick Moonen, one of the other great fish chefs in the country, about how you cook fish. It's a very delicate art. And, you know, that's why very often your mediocre cook is best doing as little to fish as possible and just getting fresh fish and leaving it alone. That's not what Eric Repair does. He leaves this great fish to speak and show you the quality of the ingredients, but his food is very inventive and interesting. And we're going to talk with his sommelier, one of the best sommelier in the world, Aldo Somme, about how to pair great wines with great fish, and that is about the highest culinary high wire act you can manage, and we'll do that in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on 1450 WCTCAM.com and RestaurantGuysRadio.com. The Feluga family at the Livio Feluga Winery are masters of modern winemaking, rooted deeply in Italian tradition. Founder and patriarch Livio Feluga has been counted among the 7 most influential Italian winemakers in the last 100 years. Signore Feluga pioneered the Friuli method. It's a style of winemaking that focuses on the purity of the fruit and the expression of the soil. It's made Livio Feluga Pinot Grigio the standard bearer for high-quality artisanal Pinot Grigio. It's serious, interesting, deeply rooted wine that speaks the very essence of Friuli, from whence it comes. But with Livio Feluga, it's not only Pinot Grigio. Feluga wines offer a world of adventurous choices. Have you ever had a wonderful Ribolla Gialla or a Picolite? Well, if you haven't, then you're missing some very special Italian wine indeed. Feluga makes red wines like Verdigo, which is Cabernet and Merlot, or Sasso, which is made with the Italian grapes Refosco and Pignolo. Start with Pinot Grigio, the way it's supposed to be, and then, through the efforts of Livio Feluga, take a tour of Friuli, glass by glass, sip by sip. Ask for Livio Feluga wines at your local wine shop, or look for them online. Tell them you heard about it on The Restaurant Guys. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, and we are talking today with our guest Aldo Sohm. Aldo Sohm was the Best American Sommelier, that's an official title, 2007. He's the sommelier at Le Bernardin Restaurant with our friend Eric Repair, who is the chef owner of Le Bernardin. And he was also recently named the Best Sommelier in the World in May 2008 at the International Association of Sommeliers competition in Rome.
Aldo, welcome to the show.
Hello, how are you?
Well, you know, whenever you're considered the best in the world at anything, that's a pretty hefty title. We're pretty honored to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Now, talk to me about the how you get to be the best sommelier in the world. What is the International Association of Sommeliers competition? I mean, I know what it is, obviously, but for our audience, it's not exactly like, you know, I think there's a difference between saying being Top Chef or Iron Chef, which is sort of geared for a television audience. This isn't really geared for a television audience. This is a recognition of you among professionals, among your peers.
Yes, it's very focused in Europe especially, because in America, Master Sommelier education has a big importance.
Mm-hmm.
And it has also in the United Kingdom. But that's about it. In Central Europe, generally, those competitions are pretty big. And everyone spends a major focus into that because it's quite a hard work to go there.
So what's hard? How are you being graded while you're there?
Well, most of the people think, you know, we recognize the most wines and that's the best sommelier. Then it would be too easy. It's written exams about wine growing, wine laws, wine growing areas, villages, certain vineyards, vintages, even about coffee, cigar, teas, liquors.
Now, but is there a practical component to it as well? Is there a service component to
it
or a blind
part,
tasting
yes.
component?
That's one part, theoretical. The practical part is to doing even the wine service,
mm-hmm.
Champagne service. Everything is under time pressure.
Now, how do you do this? Do you serve other sommeliers in a mock dining room?
No, those are judges, independent judges,
uh-huh.
Where you have to serve.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they judge how you work and give you points.
Well, now... Let's take this now. You took the title of Best Sommelier in the World for America. You competed on behalf of – you were the American entry into that competition.
Well, yeah, that's kind of Murphy's Law. You know, as you hear from my accent, I'm not from New Jersey,
right,
from Brooklyn.
you stole my joke. That's exactly how I was going to put it. So tell us how you came to represent America and tell us how you came to America. You're Austrian.
Originally Austrian, yeah, and I won actually, even in Austria, Best Sommelier in Austria 4 times. And that actually made me move to the United States because those competitions are always held in a foreign language. That's mandatory. And I picked always English. But my English was not good enough. So, you know, there was no choice. You know, either, you know, resign from competing or doing better and go in a foreign country, you know, to get fluent in the language.
So in order to immerse yourself in the language, you just decided to move here and become a sommelier here?
Yes. Of course, my best friend asked me if London wasn't far enough. From London, I didn't got the right vibe.
That's some pretty serious dedication, though, Aldo, to the, you know, I moved to Europe, but I did it for 3 months. I didn't move my whole life for 5 years to a different place.
Well, I think this gives you a unique perspective. I mean, as I guess a lot of folks have a perspective of coming across, going one way or the other across the Atlantic. But how is being a sommelier different in the United States than it is in Central Europe?
It's different because you have, especially here in New York, you know, the culinary business works a little bit different. And it's also a little bit more concentrated, meaning you have so many different cultures all together, which, of course, you have to open your perspective a little bit because you have to know what's going on in Japanese cuisine. Also, you have to know what's going on in French. And possibly certain chefs, you know, combine those flavors, which is even more challenging.
Well, now, you work for Eric Repair, a French
yeah.
Chef cooking in America, but probably, you know, one of the most celebrated, or certainly one of the most celebrated chefs in America, former guest on our show. Do you specifically like working in a French environment? Because I understand that being in New York, you need to be very aware of a lot of different cuisines. But working for Eric Repair, do you need to be aware of a lot of different ethnic cuisines?
Yes, because he has a very playful way of cooking. He uses a lot of different flavors and very delicate flavors, and his fish, he cooks it obviously in a very light way,
mm-hmm.
which is for me once in a while a little tricky, you know, in order to don't overwhelm with the wine, the food, and rather marry those.
Now, you know, being the best sommelier in the world, one of the things that I think people assume, and that is certainly true, is that if you're the best sommelier in the world, you're the guy who, if someone is going to spend a lot of money on wine or someone's very knowledgeable about wine, they really want to go to you, and you can, you know, because, you know, you're the expert in the field, you can bring people a novel adventure. But I know that you believe as well that the sommelier has a great duty to someone who's a novice in wine or someone who may not know very much about wine at all. Talk to us about that. And
telling the truth, that's for me, I have more fun doing that than the other.
Mm-hmm.
Because what is for me is always, on the end of the day, nothing is more pleasurable than you see someone coming in at Le Bernardin, possibly for the first time, you see that right away. They feel uncomfortable, and they feel nervous. And when they open a big wine list, then, you know, then it's over.
It can be very – listen, we have a pretty big wine list in our restaurants, and it's intimidating for people.
It's intimidating.
You need to do something to allay their fears.
But nothing is more fun, you know, to make these people feel comfortable right from the first second when you go there and tell them, look, it's not a problem at all. I'll find the right wine for you in even a comfortable price range, whatever it is.
You know what's funny? I sort of have a standard joke, and when you're a restaurateur, you can run with the same joke for like a couple of weeks, because then you start to get people who come back a second time, and you can't tell that joke again. But you've got a couple of weeks, you've got a whole bunch of new people to send it. My recently I've been going up to people, and I'll say, as they open the wine list, I'll say, hi, how are you? I just like to introduce myself. I'm the resident alcoholic. I've tasted every bottle on that list, but I have a great memory, and I'm highly functional, so I can, you know, help you select a bottle of wine. And I'm sort of making light of my of why I'm there. But it's a very different perception of than the sommelier of, say, 25 years ago, who was this sort of imposing figure who took an imposing wine list and made it more imposing.
Well, you know, when you work in a four-star restaurant, you know, you still, especially here at Le Bernardin, are a little bit more conservative focused. So in order to make that joke, you know, it's kind of for me very, very tough to do that.
Oh, I wasn't recommending it for you at all. And in fact, if I'd heard you'd stolen it, I'd have written you a nasty email saying you'd stolen my joke. But my point is that, you know, Mark and I have dined at Le Bernardin for lunch a couple of times, and your staff is so gracious. But the contemporary sommelier, although it's a mouthful of a word for a lot of Americans, to say that the role is to be sort of sommelier is the wine waiter, right? But it's to be the guy who comes over and removes any sense of intimidation and adds a sense of fun and adventure and fear, removes the fear from the wine list.
I think for a lot of customers who come into restaurants, I think that the wine list is the most intimidating part of the meal when you go to a really upscale restaurant. I think a lot of people, that's the part, you know, a lot of people will see foods they recognize, and you can always skip over if there's one food you don't recognize or another. But that wine list can be daunting, and I think that the role of the sommelier is even a greater one than it was 25 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. People, you will be surprised. People know very well about wines, and they have special interests, you know.
Do you find that you occasionally get a very knowledgeable guest who his goal is just to sort of trip you up or quiz you on your knowledge?
To stump
the champ.
Sommelier?
Do you find that happens at all?
Well, it happens. But, you know, you have to be cool about that. You know, if someone wants to know about something, I feel more than comfortable to answer that. If someone doesn't, you know, I have no problem to keep that for myself.
Yeah.
I don't have to show up, you know.
Well, we have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I want to talk with you about, I mean, you are an Austrian-born sommelier in America and the best sommelier in the world. And I think one of the most exciting changes to happen to American wine, probably starting in New York, is the rise of Austrian and German wines and how that's changed. So we'll be back in just a moment talking more with Aldo Sohm, the world's best sommelier, about wine in America and Austrian wine in particular. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC and restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment.
Hey, Francis, what's your first choice of hotel in New Jersey?
Easy question, Mark. It's the Heldrich Hotel and Conference Center.
You stay there because it's so convenient. Right across the street from the restaurants, right?
I stay there because it's awesome. The rooms are elegant and stylish and comfortable. The service is slick and professional and kind. Did you know they have a swimming pool and a full-service spa?
You know you're a decadent guy, right?
I do, and that's why I stay at the Heldrich.
Well, I stay there for more practical reasons. It's right in the heart of New Brunswick, so you can walk to all the great restaurants and brew pubs and cafes and three world-class theaters. You can even catch the train to Manhattan and be there in less than an hour. And if you want to dine or have a drink in the hotel, Christopher's Restaurant and Bar is right there.
The Heldrich is also great for business. In our dining rooms, we meet a ton of people who book corporate events, meetings, and conferences there, and they're all happy. With 248 rooms, 14 suites, and over 25,000 square feet of state-of-the-art meeting and conference space, the Heldrich can do up to 450 for meetings, social events, and even great weddings.
It's only 25 minutes from Newark Airport. There's a direct train from New Brunswick and frequent shuttles. How easy is that?
To plan a meeting or book a leisurely getaway, call the Heldrich at 866-609-4700. Visit theheldrich.com or click through the link on our website. Ask for the Restaurant Guys promo or online enter promo code Catherine to get a special rate just for our listeners. That's 866-609-4700, theheldrich.com, or click the link on Restaurant Guys Radio. The promo code is Catherine. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, and we're talking with the best sommelier in the world. That's not hyperbole, but an actual competition that was won by Aldo Sohm, an Austrian sommelier who is at Le Bernardin in Manhattan, sommeliering in America. But I want to talk with you, Aldo, about Austrian wine. One of the first guests we had on our show, and our show is about 3 years old now, so about 475 shows ago, our friend Peter Schleimer was one of the first guests on the show. Do you know Schleimer?
Yeah.
The laughter is that we all know Schleimer is a crazy man, friend of ours, advocate of Austrian wines, and one of our first shows was about Austrian wine. And at that time, you know, the Austrian wine in America was sort of a nascent movement, but among sort of wine geeks, wine cognoscenti, you know, that's really a hot category right now. Are you surprised by that? Will you talk to us a little bit about Austrian wine in the United States?
Well, telling you the truth, when I came over in 2004 to the U.S., I was quite surprised how Grüner Veltliner was known here.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no idea. And I was really surprised about that. And after my first summer, I had the answer. The summers are here really muggy and really hot.
Yep.
And need refreshment, so it was crystal clear then. Wine New Yorkers love that style of wine, because it's completely dry-based, really crisp, very fresh, and extremely clean in the fruit.
Now, Grüner Veltliner is a grape that's found almost exclusively in the country of Austria, and the two major grapes, and not the only grapes, for white wine from Austria are Grüner Veltliner and Riesling.
Riesling, yeah.
And I would say that before 1996, you'd never see a Grüner Veltliner in the United States, and you'd rarely see an Austrian Riesling. But from about 96 to 02 is when it really started, like the cool places had a smattering of Austrian wines. And then it's just really exploded.
And now if you want to have a great wine list, you have to carry Austrian wines.
That's
just a category that you need to have.
Kind of the fancy part right now, yes.
Now, how do you but one of the things that's interesting about carrying wines like Austrian wines is there's still a large segment of the population that's never had an Austrian wine, has maybe seen them on the list a couple of times but always wondered what they were or never even heard of them. So as a sommelier, as a restaurant professional, that's a blast to be able to take somebody who just is unfamiliar with a category and introduce them to a new category of wines, like a new place to explore. Do you find that – would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely.
Now,
it's very easy. I always go to the table and ask, you know, do you want to have something traditional, a traditional recommendation, or you want to have something adventurous? And New Yorkers are very adventurous, I can tell you that.
Well,
I always pick that.
One of the great things I think about Austrian wine.
I just need to interrupt for a second. You should preface that by saying, see, now I try to get people to go adventurous as well. And while I get a lot of takers, I think I'd get more if I said, would you like something traditional or would you like to be adventurous? And by the way, I'm the best sommelier in the world.
I never mentioned that. Never.
You should have one of your assistants come up and drop it in conversation.
Are you aware that he's the best sommelier in the world?
I'm very modest when it comes to that.
Well, you know, and as long as we're talking about Austrian wines, I think that one of the things that you need to discuss when you're talking about Austrian wines in particular is how well they marry with certain foods that don't necessarily marry that well with lots of other wines. And I think that Gruner Veltliner in particular is one of those wines that all of a sudden you can start matching Gruner Veltliner with things you wouldn't traditionally match other foods with.
Well, it's very useful, let's bring it that way, because the range is pretty big. It's from very light to dry, goes up to really powerful and rich, once in a while even oak fermented. But it's kind of this clean fruit, which is for me here extremely important, you know, to don't kill the flavors.
Well, you know, I want to talk specifically about the food at Le Bernardin and being a sommelier at probably the world, the United States' best fish restaurant. But I also want to talk about that was an interesting question you posed when you said, you know, when you say to the guest, well, would you like a traditional recommendation or would you something less traditional? I think it's not as common or traditional in American restaurants to recommend an Austrian white wine. But Austrian wine has a great tradition. I remember the second time I visited Austria, and I visited our mutual friend, Peter Schleimer, and we're both sort of motorcycle enthusiasts. So we went motorcycling around the country, and we wound up in Vienna at a winery at the Kloster Neuburg.
Yeah.
And Peter got us a private tasting, and we did a little tour, and I remember the woman said something like, we're looking at a piece of stained glass, and she said, this piece of stained glass is older than your country. And I remember the sense of history, but also they sold me, or for Peter and I to taste, they opened up some old vintages. So there are traditional wines in Austria, and the Austrian wine tradition goes back, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years.
And we look at some of these white wines and their ageability.
It's amazing.
I think people don't recognize or realize it in the United States how well these wines can age.
Oh, that's unbelievable. I had Gruner Veltliner, which 30 years old Gruner Veltliner, and they were really still fresh. Really surprising.
You know, it's funny. One of the things, Mark and I were each born in 1965. In 1965 was an abysmal year. Our business partner, Lou, is older than we are, and he was born in 1945, one of the best years for Bordeaux ever.
Yeah.
And we were born in 1965, one of the worst years in every winemaking region of the world. And so
there's some okay Armagnac out there from 65.
So we started this tradition where we would each on our birthdays buy each other a bottle of wine from our birth year. And for Lou, it's very inexpensive to do that. Now, for us, the 45s are getting kind of expensive. But when I was in Austria, most recently I was in the Wachau, and it was actually a good year in the Wachau. I have some 65s that I brought back with me. We're talking about white wine from 1965. That's still in very good condition. That's extraordinary.
It's actually in better condition than you are, Francis.
Yeah, that's fact. But that's extraordinary.
Well, telling you the truth, we spend very often too much focus to a vintage chart.
Mm-hmm.
And those charts, they can be not as precise because, look, when you review an area like California, you can't say just, you know, 2001 is fabulous and 2002 is not as good because the country is too big. You have micro
yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, though, Aldo. If you find me some good wines from 1965 that aren't from the Wachau, you let me know, all right?
Well, you know, the other thing is what belies the vintage chart and why the sommelier comes in handy. And I'm curious as to what you think about this. Because, you know, 1998 was a very difficult year, for example, in Northern California. But there were a few producers, and the problem was some rain that people didn't...
Late in the season.
That people didn't get their grapes in, and a lot of their grapes got rained on. But there were a few producers who happened to get their grapes in before the rain, who made some extraordinary wines. Staglin is an example of a mm-hmm. phenomenal wine in 98.
Kathy Corson made some great wines in 98.
But it's hard to get people to buy them because they see 98 and their vintage chart says that's a bad vintage. And they say, oh, it's 98, it can't be great.
Well, I run constantly in that issue, especially here at Burgundy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 04 was kind of that vintage too. That people said, no, I don't like 04. But 04 in white Burgundy, it's fantastic to drink. Well, and it's by far not as expensive as 05, and 04 mm-hmm. drinks better.
Well, right, that's the other thing, too.
That's the whole point, you know?
Yeah, that's the job, and what you're saying there is exactly the job of a great sommelier. It's your job, I think, I consider it my job, and you tell me if you feel the same way, that part of the job of the sommelier is to navigate that for you and to have tasted these things so that maybe I can find you a value in Burgundy, whether it's inexpensive or expensive, but is a value in Burgundy because I found you a great 04 that might be a little less expensive than that 05 and might actually be drinking better.
Yeah, that's correct. But look, when the job sommelier started, it was in the Middle Age. There was no Wine Spectator nor Robert Parkers out there.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no points. If you want to get a high-rated wine, you know, from either one of those critics, you know, you don't have to have a sommelier. You can do that on your own. It's very easy.
You know,
but,
what?
You know, if you want to get something new, possibly less expensive and really something interesting, then you need a person like that.
You know what I think? And I'm curious if you play the same game, but one of my greatest triumphs, and Mark and I both work as maitre d' and sommelier in our restaurants occasionally and sometimes in other people's restaurants. One of the great triumphs for me is a wine bar, and I also buy retail for people. I relish when I find a wine that was rated poorly by one of those large publications, and I think they got it wrong. And I relish finding a great 98 Northern California wine, one where the vintage charts say, oh, this isn't going to be great, and I say it is. That's why you want a sommelier, I think.
Exactly. I'm not going to work against those big publications,
right.
Working against those, because, look, somehow, you know, they made their reputation. I mean, they did a hard job on that, and they're quite successful on that.
And you know what? If you're in a place where nobody really knows that much about wine,
it's useful.
It's extremely useful, yes.
But when you aren't, you know, it's here, and this brings me to another point. Now, I want to see where you stand on this. We have a lot of friends in the business, you know, we all do. But it's my experience that when I go out with my wine knowledgeable friends, whether they're wine importers or sommeliers or winemakers. When we go to a restaurant, very often, if it's a place where it seems like there's a knowledgeable waiter or a knowledgeable bartender or a sommelier on staff, we'll ask for that person's recommendation, at least partly because, you know, how I explain it to my staff or when we consult for a client, and I say, listen, your key person on staff may not be the best sommelier in the world.
Well, on your staff it would be, but
most people don't have you on their staff. What we say is, listen, the sommelier's job is not, or the captain in a restaurant, if wine is part of their purview, their job is not to know the most about wine and more about wine than even all of their customers come in. But they should know more, they should know as much as anyone can about the wines that they sell, about the wines in their cellar, which is why I find that even people who know a tremendous amount about wine, when they go to a restaurant, if it's got a serious wine program, they ask the sommelier that's there. Do you do that when you go out?
I always do that because, look, again, it's kind of similar to jump quickly back to the previous question with the big publications and the big wine critics. If you stay on that path, you never discover something new.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go to, why not to go to a sommelier and have another nice conversation? Well, that's great. And he shows, look, I have something new that's really interesting. So you expand your horizon, you know?
Yeah, I'll just give you an example, the listeners an example. Last night in my restaurant, and this happens, I don't want to say every night, but very, very frequently. Last night I had somebody in the restaurant come in and say, you know, I looked at your wine list, and, you know, I usually drink cake bread. How come you don't have cake bread on the wine list? I'm sure you hear that exact question.
I hear that very often, and you bring it right now, especially to the point. I have a shortage, and I commit to that. On California Cabernets and Big Mary Tars. But why? Because if I go there with the fishes, with chef cooks, you know, I just picked the most famous one right now, a Screaming Eagle. I do have him, yes. But do I want to serve him? No, because it's like, you know, throwing a bomb over the fish because there's only the eagle. There's no more fish.
Well, if here's my view on a big wine like that. First of all, we have a lot of big steak on the menu as well. So that's probably a better choice. And secondly, if you want to give me a couple $1,000 for a bottle of wine, I'll take it.
But
still, you know, even for a steak, this wine is way too much.
I know, right. I know.
To go with a steak, you need a really crazy rich sauce.
But you get to tell your friends tomorrow that you had Screaming Eagle last night.
But that's a whole different story.
Hey, listen, we got to take a quick break. But when we come back, Aldo, I want to talk about exactly what you do. And I think they say that. There are chefs and there are fish chefs, you know, because cooking fish is a very different thing. I think there should be a similar saying for sommeliers. There are sommeliers and there are fish sommeliers because it's a whole different and more delicate and refined sort of art form. Would you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, let's expand on that after the break. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. We're talking with Aldo Somme, the best sommelier in the world, sommelier at Le Bernardin Restaurant. We'll be back in just a moment. 1450 WCTC and restaurantguysradio.com.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't, based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on Nine supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on Nine has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on Nine, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to Mark and Francis. We're talking with Aldo Sohm of Le Bernardin Restaurant. He was currently the reigning world's best sommelier. And we wanted to talk with you, Aldo, about pairing wine with fish. Because the old white wine with fish, red wine with meat, or white wine with white meat and red wine with red meat or dark meats has some utility, but it's really constraining. There are a whole lot of matches you can make outside of that. But on the same token, matching the wrong wine with fish can be pretty deleterious, well, to the fish.
We want to take it out of the maxim and put it into the suggestion.
Can you
help us do that?
Well, you know, we learned it in school, yes. White wine goes with fish, and even white meat goes with white wine goes with white meat, and dark meat goes with red wine. If you go to Italy, you'll see you get a grilled chicken breast with perhaps a little bit of rosemary and a tomato sauce, and they serve you a red wine there. So they break already the rule, so do I.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up, you know, in my childhood even I loved breaking rules, but make that smart.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you can do that, but, you know, we focus here extremely strong towards Pinot Noir, meaning also Burgundies.
Mm-hmm.
And the chef made also certain design, kind of the sauces, which are accessible for me to go with red wine. And, for instance, I have an Escolar here with a red wine Bernays, which is a Pinot Noir from Burgundy, just beautiful.
Mm. Well, I mean, let's talk about that, because what we're talking about here with Aldo, to sort of break it down out there, is, you know, red wines tend to be heavier, because red wines come from red grapes and spend some time with the skins, and the skins have a compound called tannin. Now, all wines have some tannin, but red wines have more tannin, and that's the thing that adds what we in the business call structure to a wine. You can call it bitterness, and bitterness not necessarily being a bad thing, because we need a certain amount of bitterness to make, you know, to have a balance. But too much bitterness, too much weight, and too much alcohol on a light dish like fish can overpower the fish. But there are lots of red wines that don't have that. So Pinot Noir, you're saying, is one grape that we really should look to for fish.
It would be too easy to say that. No, you got to know really your wines.
Okay.
In which condition they are, you know, and wine is always changing. So you have always to double check, you know, over a certain amount of time that the wine didn't change or close up.
Mm-hmm.
Especially Pinot Noir, you know, I'm always surprised how everyone loves suddenly Pinot Noir since the movie Sideways, and everyone hates Merlot. But Pinot Noir is very, very delicate in the vineyard, very delicate and tricky in the cellar, and also so is it in the glass. And Pinot Noir is not self-explaining. It wants to be understood.
Mm-hmm.
That's on the bottom line, versus the Cabernet is easy to understand.
Well, also I think Pinot Noir has a greater range, especially when you talk about New World Pinot Noirs. I mean, you can have some Pinot Noirs from the Santa Lucia Highlands that are, you know, you look at them and they're black and dark and juicy. And you can have some Pinot Noirs from
Washington State or
some parts of the Russian River Valley or in high altitude places that you can see through them. They're not very dark. Yeah. And you have a similar difference in flavor. Some are lighter and would go well with certain fishes, and some are almost as overpowering as Chardonnays.
Well, yeah, but don't focus on the color there.
Yeah, mm-hmm. True.
Because most of the people look always as soon as the wine is translucent or it's light. Not necessarily, because if you look, go to certain Barolos, just to pull out of Pinot Noir, you know, they're also lighter in color, but they're pretty heavy.
Yeah.
So that's not the rule here, or not the key.
Well, it's funny, but what I think with fish, especially, when you want to pair red wines with fish, I think this is when you really need a sommelier. Because, you know, with fish, you really have to be more delicate. And I think it's easy to go the road of a lighter, crisper white wine with fish. And I think that the role of a sommelier, because we have a lot of folks in the industry who listen to this podcast and broadcast, I think it's the most important thing is that your sommelier get to know the wine in the cellar
and also the food on the menu, because you talked a lot about knowing the sauces that Chef Repair pairs things with, and you know not just from an intellectual perspective, but the wines you've tasted, I assume, in your cellar.
Yeah, a lot. So, I mean, again, you have to check always how the fish is prepared.
Mm-hmm.
Is it poached? Is it seared? Is it grilled? How is it prepared? Then you have to check the sauce.
Mm-hmm.
Which are the spices? What are the sides? And all those components, you know, just a little bit, you know, to work with Chef Repair. He loves certain special ingredients, and that changes the whole direction of the dish, kind of to catch those flavors and bring them together with a wine. That's the tricky part there.
It's, you know, the thing that I think that a lot of sommeliers miss and a lot of chefs miss is they'll find some cool new ingredient to finish a dish with or to garnish a dish with. It's just the tiniest little ingredient that may not have a ton of effect on the dish itself.
No, but on the wine.
But may have a huge effect on the wine that you marinate.
I mean, something
with.
Like if a chef, I remember we were doing a wine dinner once, and a chef at the last moment, this is several years ago, decided to, he wasn't so happy with the sauces. We had tried it with the wine dinner, and he threw in some green onions at the last moment. Some
chive blossoms.
Just a little bit of them. And it turned the Chardonnay, we had the Chardonnay producer there, turned the Chardonnay, it was a train wreck. And we stopped it before it went out because we taste everything the day of the dinner. But we're like, what happened? You know, it ruined the wine. And it was almost imperceptible in the dish, but it turned the wine into a train wreck.
That's a very, very delicate issue here. Most people think, obviously, a sommelier goes to looks at the dish and says, okay, that wine goes with this and that Chardonnay.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. You know, you have to taste.
Well, now let's talk about tasting wine, because we, about 10 years ago, switched to formal service, which was at that time uncommon in the United States, and I think you see it more and more. And we did it primarily in response to the increase in the number of corked bottles. So what I mean by formal service for those in our listening area is our waitstaff will present the wine to you when you order wine. We'll then go over to the guéridon, open or the table, and then open the wine. And then the captain or the sommelier will pour him or herself a small taste of the wine, usually about a half an ounce. And the primary reason is to make sure that the wine is not corked. And we'll never pour the wine for you to taste if the wine is corked. We'll go back and get something else, or if it's the last bottle, we'll apologize and bring you something else. And that was primarily in response to some people didn't know and would accept a corked bottle of wine and drink half of it and just think the wine was awful and when it was a wine they could send back. Some people would send back wine that was perfectly good because they were insecure. So we found this solved a lot of those problems. But the happy byproduct of that is, look, I have a lot of waiters in their 20s who are very broadly tasted in some very great wines. And the way that they're tasted is they taste wines every night as a part of their job. Is that the style of service you do at Le Bernardin?
Yeah, we taste all our wines for exactly those reasons. So you don't want to come in a situation where you serve a corked wine, the mm-hmm. host can't taste it, and all the clients, they recognize that. So what they're going to do, it's a very embarrassing situation.
You know, it's funny. We
don't want to go into that.
Well, it takes all the pressure off of the client. That's one of the things we were talking about, the role of the sommelier was. The role of the sommelier is to take the pressure out of this what can be a daunting task, to be the wine host for a business meeting or for a party or whatever the case may be. It can be a daunting task. It's our jobs to take that away.
But I think that what's interesting is when we first did this, we frankly got very little pushback. I was a little concerned that people in America, because it was an unfamiliar, though it's of course that it's formal wine service in Europe forever. But we do occasionally get an outraged letter. I would say two or three times a year, someone says, you know, the waiter stole some of my wine. How dare you?
No, we have the test event, so it's a little bit more moderate. You know, you have to see it from different perspectives. You know, I'm critical right now. Certain mm-hmm. servers, they take advantage of it and they pour them a decent glass. You can't do that, of course.
Yeah.
Especially when it's a really expensive wine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we have the tiny little INAO tasting glasses rather than the taste event.
Yes, so you got to be careful how you do that.
Mm-hmm.
But look, you can even explain customers. You know, say, look, you just want to make sure that everything is perfect and we don't even bother you with a corked wine.
Well,
there's no reason to do that.
And you know what? Let's be honest about it, because obviously I want to stress that the reason that we decided to do this was to prevent flawed or off bottles from getting to the table. But the other reason is there is no way that we could have a staff that knew anything about wine, about pairing wine with food, about what the wines in the cellar were like, unless they were tasting the wines as they served them. And there's no way a 23-year-old or 25-year-old or 27-year-old waiter can afford to drink enough red Burgundy, of great red Burgundy, to know the differences among the great red Burgundy.
And even though we're tasting them on them all the time, tasting that same bottle 25 times or 50 times.
If one's a little off, you know it.
If one's a little off, you know it immediately.
Yes, that's the beautiful part on it. I mean, look, if you let people taste, that's very, very important, because why? That increases the eagerness of those persons. They are willing to learn more. Mm-hmm. I know for us Europeans, it's always interesting to see the restaurant, see how it works here. And that I was surprised about myself too when I came, because I saw the servers were most likely here actors, writers, singers, but no one had a restaurant education, which is for us very normal in Europe, you know. It's an education. It's a career.
You know, it's funny.
You're not.
One of the things that we found that is most fulfilling to us is we've been in business for 16 years now. Our first restaurant opened 16 years ago. We now have two. We do consulting for other folks. We've had a number of people come through our restaurant who are still in the restaurant business, who've gone on to open their own restaurants, a couple of people who are pursuing their master sommelier degrees. And there are a number of people who work for us and with us who maybe didn't start thinking they were going to be in the restaurant profession, but have decided that it is a profession worthy of their heart and their mind. And that's wonderful, because it is.
It's a beautiful job.
It is a great job, isn't it? Why do you think it's a great job in the restaurant business?
Why?
Yeah.
Well, look, we just spoke about it. First of all, I love to deal with people. And it's very, very different than if you're a salesperson, you have to go to someone and have to make him interested in your product, versus in my perspective, people come and they want something from us.
Mm-hmm.
It's an easier approach on top too. But you can make them happy. You know, what is more beautiful than eating and drinking?
Well, and you know, Mark and I had a shop for a while, and we have a license in New Jersey that allows us to sell packaged wine or packaged wine. And I found the retail experience, while it was fulfilling while we had our little shop, and our shop was next to the restaurant, and fortunately the restaurant grew in demand, so we made the shop into a beautiful dining room. But I found that I don't care myself, and I'm not showing any disrespect to people who love it, and thank God for all you great retailers out there, but I really enjoy the restaurant business much more, especially when selling those adventurous wines, because I would sell in the retail store some wines like I'm a big fan of, and Mark and I are both we're big fans of Sauvignon, you know, mildly oxidized wine from the Loire Valley made of Chenin Blanc. Right. Well, it's slightly oxidized in style, which in any other wine might be a sign of a flaw, but in this wine you sort of see through it, and that's part of what it's supposed to be. Well, we would sell a bunch of this. And Mark and I traveled to Sauvignon and brought in some Sauvignons that heretofore weren't available in the States. And we got old vintages of Sauvignon, and we would sell them in the restaurant. And it was wonderful because we would explain it to people, and then we would taste it before they did, so they would have the reassurance that it was how it was supposed to be. And then they would look for it, and they would see the beautiful, you know, mushrooms and heather and woodsy notes to it. But I would sell a case package to a trusted customer who would then bring it back.
Mm-hmm.
And say, oh, you know, I opened this and it's oxidized, and I'd say, well, it's supposed to be oxidized. But what can you say? You have to take it back. I love. I guess the point is, what I love about the restaurant business is you're there. I pour it for you. I watch you drink it. I look at you smile. You know, that's something very heartwarming about
it. And if you don't smile, you can't react right away.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
Mm-hmm, that's it.
Look, I tell people all the time, if they pick adventurous and they feel uncomfortable because they're not certain if the product really good. Look, what happens worst case scenario? You tell me. I need the wine anyway for my dinner, and I would love to have this.
That's
wine.
I had some exact scenario last night. Somebody I got to be sommelier last night, which I don't always get to do. So I had a lot of fun last night.
So there's no look. People feel right away comfortable. They laugh because not many people tell them that.
Mm.
So you know what's the point? It's a bottle of wine. So.
And when I say it, by the way, Aldo, I mean it.
Yeah, Mark,
I'm really going to drink that later if you don't. I picked you something I really like.
But if not, you know, I give it to take this bottle to my sommelier and we taste them again or do the stuff. You know, we spent a little bit of money, but that money is very well invested.
Yep. Well, now, how many sommeliers? You're the head sommelier at Le Bernardin.
Yeah.
How many sommeliers are on staff?
Four more.
Wow. That's quite a crew you've got there.
Yes, but we need it. You know, we increased so strong on wine pairings, and we explain people also a little bit, you know, about the wine. We tell them a little bit about the background, the grape variety, and we tell them also why we match it up with this dish, so they see the thought process behind that.
And are you on the floor yourself very often?
Yes, every day when I'm here, I'm on the floor as well. During the day, I'm in the office, unless there's something special going on. I'm not then for lunch or so on, and then for dinner.
Aldo, I want to talk just for a minute about New York City and the world today and how things might have changed or be changing. Are you seeing in La Bernardin a change in people's demeanor, a change in their habits based on the economy and the things that we're seeing around us?
I mean, let's bring it that way. We were cautious beginning from last year.
Mm-hmm.
The end of the last year, we were cautious because we thought there something is coming up, and we were right on that. So we adjusted on that. We see a little bit of difference that the group of people who order kind of $1,000 to $3,000 bottles, they reduced.
Mm-hmm.
But in the same time, we increased bottles between a couple hundred dollars.
Mm-hmm.
So those we are pretty even on that. But you know, we don't know what's going to happen.
I guess you know we don't know what's going to happen. But in good times and in bad,
but
there's
wine. Yeah, well, I have to admit, I work 20% harder right now just to keep as much as possible up to the situation.
Yeah, it's an interesting economy, but I tell you, I do find that some people are fine.
Yeah.
I think many people are really find themselves just worried when they read the newspaper every day. But I also feel, it's funny.
I read the ads.
Yeah. But you know what's funny, Aldo, is Mark and I worked in another restaurant in 1987 when the last big crash happened. And, in the 1950s and 60s and through the early 70s and the early 80s, we really didn't start to develop a restaurant culture until maybe 82, 83 through 87 or so. And so when the crash came, restaurants and dining out and good wine hadn't really been a part of people's lives. They had been a hobby for 3 or 4 years for people, but they weren't part of people's lives.
Well, look, I see it that way. You know, New York is a very quickly changing place. To change something is not a problem for a person here. But I figured one thing in my experience. People still spend money. That's not a problem. But they want to see something, they want to get something for their money.
Well,
then they have no problem to throw it out.
You know, the other thing that I see, the difference between now and 1987 is, 1987 was 19 years ago, right? 21 years ago? Mm-hmm. I can't add. It's going by quickly.
It's actually subtraction.
So that's a generation.
That might be,
but in this generation, dining has become a more important part of Americans' lives. And now that there are people who are 30 years old who've been eating good food since they were 10, and we've all been, taking this as good wine and good food as a part of our culture. And so I don't, people aren't stopping, and people are actually, I'm seeing a lot of people come to both restaurants because they just need to turn it all off and go out with their family or friends and have a few drinks and have some good food. And I think that speaks of a real change to the position of dining in our culture here.
Well, it's a lifestyle, It became to a lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
You want to eat good, and you want to have even a nice vacation. But during the year, you work hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's
true. What it came down,
And a special occasion doesn't become less special just because the economy's not as good.
No, why? I mean, we have to think positive, right?
Aldo Somme, it was lovely talking with you, and
my pleasure.
Will continue to think positive. And the next time we come into La Bernardin, we will ask for you, and we hope our listeners do the same.
Oh, definitely. Let me know when you come.
Aldo Somme, the best sommelier in the world, 2008. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC and restaurantguysradio.com. One of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to restaurantguysradio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Thank you.
Hey, we were talking to Aldo Soma. We were talking about being a sommelier and some of the great opportunities you get when you're a sommelier to interact with people. And you know, we were talking about a story last night, this true story. Last night I had a woman come in, and she was clearly intimidated by wine. She said, "I really don't like anything that's too dry." And that was kind of all she had to say.
She didn't have the vocabulary.
Because she didn't have the vocabulary, and that was okay. And we talked about that for a little while. And, you know, her guest was kind of, I don't want to say embarrassed, but clearly was like, you know, she doesn't really know what she likes. And, you know, she tries to explain, but it's sometimes hard for her to communicate. So I did exactly what Aldo was talking about. I did exactly that. I was able to say, first of all, I picked a bottle of wine that I really enjoy. And I said, listen, I was totally truthful. I said, I really enjoy this wine. So if for any reason you don't want this wine, we'll taste it. Hopefully it'll hit the what you're looking for. And if for any reason you don't like it, I'll take it back. We'll drink it later on tonight. Don't worry about it. And we'll pick something else for you. And she was totally put at ease by that. Mm-hmm. And I, again, that's what we were talking about earlier in the show. It is the job of the sommelier and the maitre d' and the waiter and all the people in the restaurant to put you at ease when you're at a restaurant. If you go to a restaurant and people aren't putting you at ease, then they're not doing their job.
Oh, you know, I think I know the table you were talking about because I spent a little time on the floor last night in both restaurants, and I'm sure that it was table 52.
It was 52.
Yeah, sure, 52. I know that couple. I don't know if you know this, but what you recommended the wine. I saw that you had recommended a wine to them. I saw mm-hmm. your table side opening there, and I just went over to say hello to everybody. You know, Mark did the real work last night. I just, you know. Walked around and said
I'm
hello.
Gonna say what else is used, what else is new,
and took credit for things. But I was working in the office very hard on other stuff. But I came up to say hello to everybody in both restaurants, and I happened to pass through that table, and then I came by again an hour later to just check on things. And you were doing a great job, by the way.
Thanks so much. Appreciate you looking out for me there.
But I spoke to that woman, and she said, I think because she thought I was your boss. She said.
You're not.
I know. She said, you know, the young man who recommended the wine did a very good job.
You know why she said that?
Why?
Because you look older than me.
Oh, but we're both looking older. You don't look like the young man. I said, yeah. So anyway, I said, oh, that's what's his name again? I said, that's Mark. I almost said, he's a good boy. He's been with us for a long time. But I didn't. But she said, you know, he did a great job. And when he first poured it, my husband liked it a lot. But I thought it might have been a little bitter. But I sort of, you know, my husband really liked it. And it was okay. But now that I've had it through dinner, I really like it now. And that's another interesting thing about wine. Take a moment. If initially you're a little put off by something, drink a half a glass of it over the course of 10 or 15 minutes, and see how you feel about it. Because two things happen. One is sometimes wine changes, and this is something people don't realize. Sometimes you change.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you get used to something. Sometimes, you remember your first, people who like coffee, you remember your first sip of coffee? You think, why would adults drink that? It's bitter. But then you sort of get past it, and you see a really good cup of coffee. You see through the bitterness, and that's how we sort of grow and expand, and this can happen with wine as well. So what I'm saying is just, you know, be open-minded. There's a lot of great stuff out there.
And the other thing is, and this is a lot of professional people, when you're tasting, you know this. You just, when you're tasting something, you always want to give that a second try because that first taste is affected by anything else that you might have done before that.
Right, brush your teeth, have a Tang,
Fig
Newton, whatever.
You know, use the orange juice in the morning right after you brushed your teeth analogy.
Right.
It's very similar to that.
But if you judged all orange juice on that, you'd never have orange juice
you
again.
Would never have
and
it
wouldn't
again.
Wouldn't that be sad?
So it's always good to taste the wine at least twice. And like Francis said, if you can, to taste it over a 10 or 15 minute period. But honestly, if that woman had said, you know what, I really don't care for this, I would have been perfectly happy to take it and
drink it with
else.
Me in the office, and I would have told you that story last night.
I would have been extra happy, actually, I guess, then, huh?
Well, it looks like the clock on the wall says it's time for last call for the restaurant guys.
Really?
I'm afraid it does. I hope that you've all enjoyed the hour with us and Aldo Soame of La Bernardin. You can email us, mark@restaurantguysradio.com or francis@restaurantguysradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. And Restaurant Guys on restaurantguysradio.com, iTunes, or WC.